So the CFMEU stands for the Construction Forestry Maritime Employees Union. It's the largest union in construction. So they do sort of forestry, maritime, and there's also more recently been the bringing in of the manufacturing division. So for a while it was called the CFMMEU, which is a nice mouthful. They are the most powerful union numerically in terms of density, but they're also the most powerful union in terms of sheer wins that they've managed to achieve. They're also sort of a perennial thorn in the side of the Labour Party. So they're they campaign for the Labour Party, they donate millions to the Labour Party, but they're also quite strong in terms of the wins that they've managed to get off the Labour Party as well. So the current Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, hates the CFMEU and he always has. What I kind of also argue to a point is that a lot of this is about personalities, which is incredibly frustrating, particularly for rank and file construction workers. The CFMEU have historically managed to extract some tremendous wins for their workers. Notably, in the last year, they essentially strong-held the government into forcing legislation to ban silicosis, so engineered stone, which was incredibly dangerous. And you know, workers are suffering the consequences still to this day. Incredible sort of health issues, lung issues that workers have died from and will suffer long-term chronic illnesses for. One of the biggest differences in our industrial relations space is that from the early 2000s, there've been some pretty significant changes to our industrial relations framework, whereby we actually cannot strike unless we're in instance of negotiating an agreement. So we can't have a grievance and then go and vote to go on strike unless we're in a period of enterprise bargaining. So sometimes the only time that we can go on strike is every 3 years. If there was a major, you know, if for example, we negotiate our agreement, we have a little strike, whatever, we get our wins, we get our agreement, and then the bosses decide to sack a bunch of workers afterwards, we can't go on strike afterwards because of that. Otherwise, we're fined millions of dollars by our sort of major tribunal, which is ironically named the Fair Work Commission. Something that the CFMEU have been able to do is take on and absorb those millions of dollars worth of fines because they're so powerful in terms of numbers. So they've managed to get some tremendous, like they're some of the highest paid workers in the country. And in terms of the construction workers themselves, CFMEU members are paid significantly more than construction workers who are not CFMEU members. In the sort of meantime, what we have is a period of really low union density. So currently, we are at 12.5% union density across the country. So 12.5% of workers are union members. Today, ABS statistics came out that we have grown by 0.6. So that's something like 120,000 workers if you take into the population, which obviously I think some folks in the union movement are sprouting as sort of the biggest success to have ever occurred. I mean, I think it just demonstrates that there's a lot more work to do. We have very low union density, and what the CFMEU represents in that context of low union density, in the context of the kind of destruction of workers' rights, but also the concept of the unions, what the CFMEU represents and what they have represented throughout the 21st century are criminals and thugs. They're big, they're bulky, they do illegal industrial work to get good wins, and they've been painted in the media by such. One character who potentially hasn't done them any favours, I would argue, is the secretary of the Victorian and Tasmanian division. His name is John Secker. And so this is where it all sort of starts. So in August, there was a expose by a investigative journalist who's very prolific in Australia. His name's Nick McKenzie. And it's unfortunate because before this, he had just come off the back of winning a Walkley, the big journalist award, because he had exposed Ben Robert Smith, who was one of the country's most respected war veterans, for war crimes. And the trial that he wrote an article accusing Ben Robert Smith of war crimes in Afghanistan, really, really heinous stuff. Ben Robert Smith sued him for defamation, and then that defamation case became this sort of war crimes trial. Like, international lawyers were like, we are amazed by what's occurring right now that we can all see. And he was found guilty. So now everyone can go around and say Ben Robert Smith is a war criminal. So he's come off the back of that, and he released this sort of expose. It was called Breaking Bad, where he talks about what he calls an unholy alliance between gangland wars, where the CFMEU had become a fiefdom, in which bikies and standover men were given positions of power on building sites. He said this created a culture that was toxic, and that organized bikies had infiltrated the most powerful union. And he also said the CFMEU had handed over their industrial power to gangsters. The next week was the Conservatives attacking the Labour Party for, you know, this is what we always knew. When the Conservatives had been in power for the previous sort of 12 years, so from 2013 until 2022, they'd done Royal Commission into union corruption, in which nothing came out of it. They attempted to put an omnibus bill in, industrial relations omnibus bill, in which would allow all unions to be put under administration. That was actually rejected famously by one of our most prolific like far right parties, Pauline Hanson's party, rejected it under the basis that all unions shouldn't be put under administration. But I'm digressing. But basically, we're at this period where there were some video recordings and some allegations that were made. Within that, before anything had been taken to a court to be tested, any of these allegations, what had happened was over 180 workers across the country had been stood down over allegations that the Tasmanian and the Victorian division were infiltrated by corruption. So the entire national CFMEU were painted with these accusations, even though they were just laden at, or they were just labelled towards a state and a territory, particularly under this secretary, John Secca. Now, what John Secca says is that when he thought these allegations were about to come out, he sat down with the Labour Party and he said to them, look, let's do a deal. I'll step back. I'll resign. We can get the public sort of further out of it, but don't come for the CFMEU. The Labour Party are, of course, denying that meeting ever took place. And what essentially happened was, within a couple of weeks, they put through this legislation that is called the administration. So I'll just run through some of the things that this bill, which was achieved, you know, was brought in by the Labour Party, can do to a union. So the bill puts the construction and general division and all of its branches into administration, including WA, and so that's Western Australia and the Australian Capital Territory, and in Queensland. So without these allegations being labelled at them, they were only for one area. They take effect immediately without any trial to determine whether or not these allegations, any of them, had been true. The bill gives the minister the power to issue a legislative implement that establishes the rules for the administration. It must last for at least 3 years. And it's got these provisions that are around, specifically around the suspension or the removal of officers, so sacking organisers. The administrator is able to declare offices as vacant, and that's through sacking elected officials. So these are officials that have been elected by their members to represent them. They're able to be sacked by the administrator at his whim. And it is his. It's Mark Irving's, the current administrator. They can determine the timing of elections, disciplinary actions. They can terminate CFMEU employees, after which they can also change the constitutional rules of the union. They can employ people to assist the administrator. The minister, importantly, the bill says that the minister does not need to have regard for the rules of natural justice, which is just absurd. In terms of the powers while under administration, the administrator controls everything as if it were the union. So the bill allows provisions for the management and disposal of property, spending of money, performing any functional power that any official or branch or division could perform. People sacked or suspended are effectively banned for life. This is through creating a category within the Fair Work Act called removed person. So this removed person can be any official, employee or union delegate who's sacked, removed from their position or suspended during the administration, and it prevents them from ever acting as a bargaining representative again unless they get permission from the Fair Work Commission. So this means employees, delegates, officials that are removed by the administrator can't represent workers in enterprise bargaining negotiations anywhere and potentially for life. The bill also prevents removed persons from running for any union office or working for any union unless they get permission from the tribunal. It gives the administrator the power to change the rules of the division. There's no requirement that members are there to approve those rule changes. The normal process obviously does not apply. So normally when elected representatives are changing their rules. The bill gives the administrator the power to compel people to provide information, surrender documents and provide assistance, and compel staff, former officials and staff, and people who have done work for the division in any capacity, and then anyone who refuses to provide this assistance can be fined almost $200,000, which is what, £100,000. There are new criminal offences. So it makes, the bill makes it a crime to act in a way that prevents the administrator from being able to do its job. So under this scheme, the criminal penalty is up to 2 years in prison, or nearly $100,000, which is £550,000. But I mean, more broadly, what it means is that people who try to defend their union can be fined or jailed, right? So what we're seeing is, I mean, when I speak to rank and file tradies, it's not the mobsters or the gangsters that are intimidating them. It's folks from the administrator that are waiting around in car parks trying to see what they're up to, right? The administrator can't be sued, so it's not liable for any civil proceedings or loss or damage of any kind as a result of the administration. And then members pay for it all. So members are basically paying for the destruction of their entire union. But 2 months before these allegations came out, there was a bit of a discussion around maybe there were some problems within the Victorian and Tasmanian division. So what happened was the National Secretary, Zach Smith, he decided to put the Victorian and Tasmanian branch into an internal administration where he got a QC to do an investigation and to do a report. Now that report was rushed through by the administrator, and so it came out in September, and I got sent a copy from a journalist when it happened. And so I went through it at the time. I mean, I think what's really important to note is what that report found is that there was a cycle of violence in the construction sector more broadly, which is that there are two elements to this. One, when the discussion is purely around the fact that there are criminal elements within the CFMEU, there's zero discussion around the fact that the developers are aided and abetted by gangs. When we look at, maybe seen as this has been recording, I won't say names, there's a very big developer near my area who's completely backed by the Calabrian Mafia, for example. So when we're looking at the notion that just the tradies within a particular union are kind of succumbing to these elements of criminality and corruption, there's no consideration taken about the fact that the construction sector not only is one of the most dangerous places to work, but there's widespread corruption outside of the union movement by bosses who implement incredible levels of violence on union officials and on their members as well, and have horrible conditions. So just recently, there was a really, really awful occupational health and safety situation where workers were essentially working around someone who had passed away, right? They were still working, and the CFMEU had attempted to come in multiple times and were denied access. So there's that element. The second element is that what we had was an acknowledgement in the report, which none of the media talked about. So the media said there were criminal elements in the CFMEU. That's what this interim report says. So the other point that it made that nobody read or took into consideration, by nobody, I mean the media, I mean the journalist who rung me and asked me what my thoughts were on it, was that when folks go to prison, a lot of men in particular are paid by the state to do construction and trading qualifications in order to get jobs in construction. So yes, there are former criminals working in construction because it is seen as a second chance or a final chance for workers. Where do folks go when they leave prison? A lot of them work in construction. None of that nuance was taken into consideration, obviously, in this discussion around it, right? Anyone was a criminal. Anyone was a mobster. Anyone was a gangster. Some really wild suggestions too. I mean, one of the recommendations was that police should have a better relationship with the CFMEU, even though the interviews that he conducted was that the CFMEU officials, anonymous interviews that this KC, Jeffrey Watson, conducted, said that officials had been threatened with tremendous amounts of violence, but there was no way they were ever going to go to the police. Like, there was a lack of trust in the police that wasn't going to happen. So bosses were using violence and intimidation on officials, paid officials, who were potentially also using threatening violence, but none of them were going to go to the police about it. So, I mean, some of the recommendations were obviously just not really reasonable or realistic in that sense. So that happened. Then what we had was within a month of the administrator happening and installing an official that was unelected to the position of secretary, was named Graham McCulloch, and he was the founder of my union, the NTU, and in disgrace after about 2 weeks, I think, he was forced to resign because of sexual harassment. We've got a situation in which, you know, the administrator doesn't even know who he's employing. So I kind of want to take folks back to the accords, the prices and incomes accords, because that's really important to understanding the Australian Labor Party and how it operates, I believe. We'll go back to the 80s. So folks probably here know about the sort of, you know, Blair, Third Way, Gordon Brown, et cetera, et cetera. What a lot of people don't realise, and Bob Hawke said famously that Blair stole the Third Way from them. So what happened in the Australian Labor Party is that at the same time we had two prime ministers called Bob Hawke and Paul Keating, so in the 80s and the 90s. What they did in this period was that they had this real switch to the Third Way, neoliberalism, but they did it within the accords through the prices and incomes accords, which was an attempt to achieve consensus and find common ground between business and unions. What happened was there was a real period of high inflation, high unemployment, and lots of strikes at that period. It was quite a tense setting. So the prices and income accords was a summit that wanted to bring business and unions together to sort of shift Australia's economic management. And that became the prices and incomes accord. It was this tripartite agreement signed by the Labor Party and the Australian Council of Trade Unions at the time. And so it was this sort of refusal to accept that bosses and workers were fundamentally opposed and that they had actually more in common. What it did was that it created a trade-off, and there was sort of this production of a social strategy of consensus and an economic strategy of restraint and of growth. Key to the accords was an emphasis on the social wage, where unions agreed to moderate their wage demands in exchange for greater benefits when around social welfare areas, around tax, for example, around healthcare, education and welfare. So the wage restraint was central to the accords, and it was considered necessary. What it did, though, is what many would argue, that it deepened neoliberalism and corporatism within the Australian sort of framework. It weakened union power because of the centralisation of the wage bargaining. So the accord shifted wage setting from a workplace level bargaining to centralised agreements. And it helped to stabilise inflation, but it reduced the ability of individual unions and their members to negotiate wages and conditions directly. And it weakened the direct influence of unions at a workplace level. It also resulted in the suppression of industrial action. So this was actually a condition within the accords. And so strikes and other forms of collective action were actually discouraged to maintain economic stability. Then there was this focus by the unions on national macroeconomic objectives like inflation, rather than sort of those bread and butter issues around specific worker demands. And so this shift often alienated union members and left a lot of them feeling like their local sort of issues were being ignored, right? What this resulted in, many would argue, obviously the Australian Labor Party would not argue this, they would vehemently disagree, but if we look at the numbers, I mean, it doesn't lie. At the time that the accord was negotiated, union membership was 51.4%, and that was in 1983. Now union membership is 13.1% as of today. We're starting to see in this period unions become way more embroiled in political compromises than we ever have. And I think part of this is the reason why the CFMEU, some of the stuff that they were starting to do, they were coming for public housing at the moment. They were basically demanding that the government start to focus on more public housing, green bans. They were doing some really great work around Palestine. Some of the only unions that were putting their tools down for Palestine. Particularly around the encampments at some universities. We do have a housing crisis of sorts for our, you know, 25 million population. And you know, what the Conservative Party was saying was, oh, well, that's the problem right here. It's these gangsters and criminals that are slowing up your houses from being built. You know, what we had was a really, really staunch union that is, because of the Labor Party primarily, is now being able to be sort of destroyed through... year in, year out, what will happen is if this administration stays into place and there isn't an effective campaign at a community level and at a worker level, we're going to see membership drop off. And this is very similar to what happened in the Builders Labourers Federation. So the Builders Labourers Federation was around this period in the 80s. They were a really, really staunch union run by a lot of notorious communists at the time, who did really great work, particularly in Sydney, around a lot of the kind of over-industrialisation that was happening and the destruction of land and public parks, etc. They had some amazing worker-led, kind of delegate-led meetings. But their member meetings that are being run, they're talking about political ideological issues. What happened was the exact same thing happened. So there were elements of criminality and corruption. And Bob Hawke, the Labour Prime Minister at the time, deregistered them. They were unable to financially operate. So they kind of split, they moved on. And eventually what we have a lot of them is in what became the CFMEU. So that's why the Defend the Unions, Defend the CFMEU campaign is called the way it is, because it used to be called Defend the Unions, Defend the BLF. It's not the only campaign that's going on. I think something that the Defend the Unions, Defend the CFMEU campaign are trying to do is bring in community on board, which is really important when the public narrative is just, these are all criminals and gangsters. What I'm seeing at the moment, which I think is really concerning, is a big schism split between your more sort of traditional working classes, or all, you know, blue collar unions and white collar kind of more professional unions. So what we're seeing is a big issue around the question of misogyny. John Setcar did not have the best reputation. Him and his wife had a court case and a whole bunch of other stuff happened, which as far as I'm concerned actually has nothing to do with the administration itself at all. But that's a discussion that's been had. So our union, the NTU, which is the Tertiary Education, Higher Education Union, is the first union to have a white-collar union, to have opposed the administration. But that was off the back of three really intense days where I was working alongside comrades from Sydney and other comrades to try and get the national executive to even let us debate it. They were trying to suppress it. And the reason why is they started to talk about misogyny. So this idea of these kind of unions that are run by men, that they hate women, da-da-da-da-da, they're all disrespectful to women, etc. Our argument was this actually has nothing to do with the administration, but more importantly, when we're looking at misogynistic elements within construction, we know that the workers that have the women workers that have the best conditions in the construction sector are union members. So we had the amazing folks at FILIF, which is the Italian Federation of Italian Workers and Their Families in Melbourne. They held a public forum to talk about the CFMEU. They had a really amazing worker from Macedonia, and she got up there and she said, oh, it was amazing. She said, I migrated to Australia and I was, I think she was a single mum. Either way, she needed to get flexible work hours for her kids. She said she walked into a boss's office. She said, can I get flexible work arrangements? They said, no, you can't. She said, oh, okay, what do I do? And she went to her union, and then the next day she had flexible working arrangements sorted. She said that she's experienced a lot of misogyny in the construction sector, but never from comrades in the CFMEU. So I think what we have is that we've got the ETU, the Electrical Trades Union, and the MUA, who are the Wharfies, who actually let us use their space for our community meetings. They're all opposing the administrator because they understand the implications that this is setting for workers' rights. Meanwhile, you have the Nurses Union, the ANMF, the ASU, the Australian Services Union, CPSU, the Public Service Union, and other unions who are not budging at all. What we're also seeing is a sort of attempted split by some of these working class unions to split from their affiliated kind of peak body to form their own blue collar version of that. So, I mean, it's really concerning in a period in which we've already, like, I've expressed how low the density is of unions, and then what we're going to have is a split between those. So that's happening. I've painted a pretty depressing light on it. All I would say is, and I mean, I think I'm preaching to the converted in the sense of, I mean, the fundamental argument is the fight doesn't stop when the Labour Party comes into government. If anything, you ramp it up more, because I feel like we know from hopefully what I've set out is actually they have more of a capacity to be able to really institute damaging implications for unions themselves rather than just industrial relations legislative stuff, Maybe the Tories can do that. That's fine. But what Labor parties have done very, very well in Australia is to individually destroy work, the capacity for workers to organise. So what we've got are a lot of unions that essentially campaign for the Labor Party, but are not achieving substantial wins for their workers, which is a really big problem. The main thing is that the Defend the Unions, Defend the CFMEU, if I wanted me to share, they had a really good public meeting the other week. They're trying to get basically more public support. There's another group called Your Union, Your Choice, which I think are more focused on the High Court case. So currently, I think it's going to be tomorrow. The High Court is going to hear whether or not what the administration is constitutes a breach of political communication and political assembly. If we take into consideration the fact that not a single person, following all of these allegations, not a single person has been found guilty in a court. Like, no one yet. There's one case that's going to be had from it, from an Indigenous organiser who's currently still working at the CFMEU, and that everyone thinks that case is going to be dropped. So what we've got is essentially an attempted demise of a union without any kind of founded allegations that have been, someone's been found guilty and they've gone to prison or they've been fined as a result. Meanwhile, employers are using it as an excuse to roll back agreements. Workers are going to die from this administration and this legislation. Workers are being sacked unfairly across the country and they've been stood down without any recourse. There's just some things, but also what the folks asked me to do was they said what would mean a lot to them, and it really does mean a lot to them. I know we talk about the sort of signs of solidarity and stuff, but you know, even when I told some of the rank and file tradies that I was coming here, they were so, like, they were really happy. They were like, yeah, we'll all get on the Zoom and we'll all chat, fuck the administrator. Like, they were really happy that folks were, that one, folks cared and that folks were listening about this. So if you feel like you want to go back to your union and do like a motion of solidarity, they'd really love to see it. So I put a little QR code that I've lugged across the continent, or across the oceans maybe is better. I put a little QR code here that you can have a look at what the signs of solidarity are. I think there's one from a trade union in the US and one in Sri Lanka, another one. So that's here as well. Happy to discuss and chat and questions and vibes and feelings. Thanks for having me.